Well, heartily welcome to today's podcast hosted by the Telex Institute and the World Forum for Ethics and Business. My name is Christoph Glaser and I'm a CEO at the Telex Institute. Today, we want to talk about breath-based mindfulness in the agile transformation. And obviously, these are quite many buzzwords in one sentence. So what is our intention here? We would like to have a discussion with two great leaders on the incredible speed of change in the world and the importance of finding that inner stability, that inner calm, that self-awareness to live well, to be resilient, and to have a creative mindset. We'll all remember the famous quote of Professor Klaus Schwab, head of the World Economic Forum, who has famously said that probably change will never be as slow as it is today. And it is commonly believed that in the next 10 years, a good 40% of today's businesses won't exist anymore if they are not able to transform in the speed and direction which is needed. Probably another 50% of today's jobs will not exist anymore. So the world has become more volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous. We call it the VUCA world. And the question is, what do individuals need? What do organizations need to be able to not just kind of adapt, but actually lead that change? So to discuss on the implications of these transformational times and the importance of mindfulness in coping with it, we have invited, and I'm so happy that you have both confirmed, two very special guests, both from different fields. We have a leader in the field of science, a professor at Yale and Stanford, who has done an incredible amount of research on the topic of happiness, health, mindfulness. And on the other hand, we have a leader from the business world, responsible for people and culture in one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world. So today's podcast is a meeting between business and science, and I very much look forward to it. So let me introduce to you Professor Emma Seppälä. She's a lecturer at the Yale School of Management, Women's Leadership Program. She's an international keynote speaker and author. In fact, her book, The Happiness Track, I've read it myself, has been translated in dozens of languages. It's a bestseller. And she's also a science director of at the Stanford University Center for Compassion and Altruism. Welcome, Emma. It's wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you, Christoph. It's always a pleasure to meet with you.
And I would also like to welcome Thorsten, Mr. Thorsten Dahlhofer. Thorsten, you are such a well-read, highly trained leader and consultant with a wealth of experience amassed in over 20 years. You have worked as a consultant and a facilitator for large organizations, MSEs, and multinational organizations, active in the banking, logistics, and insurance industry. And today, you are an organizational development expert at Roche, and you also work as an independent consultant. Thorsten, thank you for taking the time. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me. Hello, Christoph. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Thorsten.
Now, Emma, it almost seems to me you have been working on the topic of health and happiness your whole life. And obviously, Corona has brought the speed of change in our world to a completely new level. This last year has surely changed all of us. It has sometimes shocked us. It has probably brought us out of balance. And it was a test to the resilience to all of us. If I look at the Telex Institute, for example, if I look back to February 2020, we basically were walking into a wall. All our seminars were canceled for the next 3 to 6 months. And it was all about developing a new business model, finding a new way to make a difference and reach out. I used to happily travel to clients, spend the time with people in one room. I loved it. It meant a lot to me. It felt so purposeful. Every week, I used to travel around in the world, and maybe I could jokingly say the world was my living room. Today, the living room is my world, the Zoom is my world, and so it is for all of our trainers. So we had to be agile, we were forced to it. And yes, after 1 year, I think we have been able to live that change and make a difference and be useful to the world again. So I was wondering, how have you experienced these 12 months? What was your biggest challenge, maybe in your personal life and as a professor at the Yale University? How did you cope with it?
Well, I think I felt very fortunate. I mean, everything moved online, and to me that felt very seamless. So I was just felt really lucky. Also, we had continued childcare. We were kind of a pod with our nanny. So we were very, very fortunate. You know, I was trying to do whatever I could to support, people around me. But, I have to say that it was seamless, and, moving online just felt, it felt like it worked, you know. I think we've all learned is, wow, we can connect this way too. And we can connect meaningfully too, which is a relief, because if we hadn't been able to do that, I think we'd be in an even sort of more challenging place right now. And we've been very lucky to all be healthy and stay healthy. So we're deeply grateful and just really lucky, honestly.
Yeah, that's really great. So I was wondering, Thorsten, I think also you enjoy a lot being with people, being in direct touch. You're also living in this virtual world now. How have you coped with it? And what was your biggest challenge and learning 1 year into the pandemic?
I was torn, quite frankly, because as you said, my job is to go out there and interact with people, and of course that was taken away completely, right? And we were all stuck behind the screen and looking into that little hole at the top of the screen and try to continue doing what we do on through that medium. So that felt bad in the beginning, and I was one of those guys who was very vocal in saying this will not work and we can't turn everything online, and my performance is based on me being able to be in the room and use my presence in the room and so on and so forth. So that didn't feel that good. On the other hand, I'm a highly introvert person, so I didn't mind being at home by myself with my dogs and not constantly having to interact with people and stuff. So that felt good, you know, or that was convenient in a way. So it was really, I was oscillating between those two ends of the continuum for quite a while in the beginning.
Now, today we talk about breath-based mindfulness in the agile transformation, and obviously Thorsten, new work for a company which is living and breathing that agile transformation. In fact, Roche, I believe, has made it to one of the most important goals to become agile over the last couple of years, and with an incredible kind of collaboration, you were able to produce one of the first, if not the first, Corona test in the world almost a year back, which is certainly a testimony of true agility and collaboration. So how would you actually define what is an agile transformation, and what is the key to be successful in it?
It's a big question. You know, I think the key was, and that's also what an agile transformation is in the shortest description that I can give. It's questioning all the mantras you believed in and lived up to on a daily basis, right? Questioning how you do things and being willing to throw everything overboard and do it differently. If you find out that there's a better way of doing it, or a better process that suits this specific situation, right? And I think we were, as Roche, we were very lucky that our senior leaders took the decision to go on this journey to become a more agile organization 4 or 5 years ago already. So this has been going on for a while already in Roche. So when the pandemic hit us or hit the world last year, we were already 4 years into this agile transformation. And so it was almost like we've just been presented with the best test case ever to try and see what Agile can really do and whether our transformation can bring the results that we need right now. And as you said, it worked out extremely well. You know, we were able to have a first solution ready after less than 4 months, something that typically takes us 7 years to take a new product to the market in that field, right? And I think that was only possible because people were just trying to find, everybody who was involved was just trying to find the best way to tackle this problem, regardless of what the process is, regardless of how we've done it in the past, regardless of what we think we know. Everybody was just trying to figure out what the best way to deal with this situation. And the leaders were brave enough to either sit still and watch what's happening and let it happen, or actively support it. You know, and I think it takes guts to do that, because a lot was at risk, of course. A huge reputational risk. If you're in this situation, the first one to take a product to the market.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, you're saying the leaders were, they had the courage to sit still, yet they had to be so fast. And I think the way I understand agility, it's really that combo, that magic, let's say silver line between being fast and stable and still aware at the same time. And that brings that flexibility. And that really brings the topic of mindfulness into the picture, because sometimes when we need to be so fast, we are driven, we are on autopilot, and guess what? All we do is replicating our patterns. So Emma, I think you have studied the topic of mindfulness for the last, I would say, 20 years or so. And I've also been in the field of delivering mindfulness programs in corporations for about this time. And what I have seen, quite frankly, is that obviously, initially, 20 years ago, it was still difficult to do so. People did really not understand what has a mindfulness program to do with, let's say, performance. People felt this could be done in a yoga studio, but not in the business world. This has changed. We know that every morning at the World Economic Forum, mindfulness classes are happening. The biggest organizations of the world, like Roche, SAP, Google, etc., are using it. Yet, what I have seen is that when people are really driven, and if they yearn for that relaxation, they want to sit down, they want to meditate, they want to relax, it is not that easy. Sometimes when we close the eyes, all we experience is the stress and the many thoughts we have. So here the breath plays a very important role. We know that it impacts very much our autonomous nervous system, and it can help us to relax. So from a scientific perspective, Emma, why is breath so important to help relax, unwind, and dive into that space of mindfulness?
Yeah. So I think what's interesting is, first of all, I think what Torsten just said was so fascinating, this ability to observe and move. And that has so much to do with this ability to be mindful, to be clear-headed, but also innovative, right? And so how do you get there? Look, if you ask people, audiences from around the world, what is the one technique you've learned to handle your own emotions? People are going to say, just stuff them down, suppress them, bottle them up. That's just generally, you know, I mean, whether it's people from Europe, the US, all over the world, that's the general sort of message we've learned about how to handle our emotions. And, you know, whenever you ask, well, how's that working out for you? People usually say, it's not working out for me, right? I mean, and so that's interesting. But let's look at the research. If you look at the research on handling our emotions this way, which is the way that most people have learned it, it actually makes the emotion worse. So for example, let's take anger. If you have anger or stress, right, and you bottle it up and you don't show it on your face, you're like, I'm fine. Actually, the physiological impact on your body is all the more. So anger, we know, has a very big physiological toll on your body, heart rate, blood pressure, inflammation, etc. But when you suppress it, all of those systems actually increase. And even at the level of the brain, you see that the emotion centers are even more activated. So basically, whenever we suppress something, it's like you take a soda bottle and you're shaking it up. I mean, it just gets more intense. And I think we've all seen that in our lives. Either you explode at some point, or it comes out as passive aggression, or you get sick, right? That's just one of the things that happens when you're constantly doing that. And so what I find really interesting here is that, okay, what have psychologists recommended? This thing, reappraisal. I'm sure you've heard of it. If you've been in a therapy session or talked to a therapist, you've heard of cognitive reframing, restructuring. Basically, look at the situation from a different perspective to make yourself calm down in the moment. Now, that is all fine and good if you're talking your way out of a parking ticket or something like that. But imagine a big stressor in your life, a big personal stressor. You know, I think we've all experienced that in our life at some point where your emotion is so strong. There's no talking your way out of it, right? You know what's less helpful is when someone else comes up to you and says, why don't you calm down, right? That's even less helpful. So why? Because when our emotion centers are that highly activated in our brain, we actually lose the ability to use the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of our brain that is responsible for logical thinking, for reappraisal, for sort of the rational mind, right? So what then? What do you do? And I think that is where it's really interesting to think about breathing, because in those moments, you can't rationalize your way out of the emotion. It's not happening. But if you change your breathing, you actually start to trigger the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the calming response. That's the opposite of the fight or flight or the stress response, right? And so in that moment, within minutes, you can actually change your ability to think rationally, your ability to think logically, your ability to innovate, your ability to be emotionally intelligent, your ability to be a good decision maker, because you've regained your ability to think clearly. So that is probably the most basic way in which using breathing exercises in particular is probably the most efficient technique for regaining your mental balance and your mental ability to sort of handle the situation successfully.
Thanks, Emma. I really love that picture of a soda bottle. And I must admit, I'm practicing mindfulness since 25 years. But during this lockdown, I sometimes also feel like a soda bottle. Nevertheless, I do appreciate the benefit of the techniques, of course, very much. Now, Emma, you have done so much research on the impact of, let's say, breath-based mindfulness techniques on happiness, on health. And there's a strong link there. At the same time, you're also alluding to the fact there's a strong link between these techniques and thinking clearly or being able to even be innovative. And there's research on the impact of flow. McKinsey, for example, has published a study which indicates, they have done with more than 5,000 people over 10 years, which indicates that when being in that state of flow, their employees were almost five times more productive. How do you see our ability to be in flow today, where we are constantly interrupted, and how can then mindfulness play an important role?
Well, let's think of our abilities to innovate. So if you ask, you know, if you ask yourself or really anyone, like, when is it that you get those aha moments, those ideas that come to you when you've been working on a problem and you're trying to figure out a solution, and all of a sudden you're in the shower or somewhere and you're like, oh, here's a solution, right? So you will find that you get those ideas, those innovative solutions, those new perspectives when you are in a relaxed state. So when you're in the shower, you're taking a walk, you're in the car, you're not on your phone, you're not focusing, you're not concentrated, sweating at your computer, you're relaxed. And so we know from research on creativity that we're most likely to get those aha moments when our brain is in alpha wave mode. What does that mean? It means it's not so relaxed that it's almost asleep and it's not focused. It's in that in-between state you could call a meditative state of mind. And so if you can help people to be in that state more, you know, as a leader, for example, in a workplace, you don't want people to overwork constantly day and night, because actually you're limiting their ability to access that state, right? That's why you want to encourage, you know, time off. You want to encourage space and lower pressure in some senses. I mean, it's good to obviously give people goals. That's important for creativity, but within that space, allowing them to access that alpha wave mode. And so practices that, like breathing, et cetera, like the sky breath meditation that you teach, Christopher, any of those relaxing techniques can help people access that space fairly quickly, thanks to the physiological sort of pathways that we talked about earlier.
Yeah. And that's obviously absolutely great. You know, many a times when working with leaders, people, senior leaders can be quite shocked and kind of feel not good about the fact that many times at the workplace or in key meetings, they're not really able to be creative. They don't have the best thoughts at work. And obviously, Einstein already said that he never had his best ideas at work. He used to have them under the shower or going for a walk. Something happens with our mind, isn't it? Sometimes that flow happens, and that's when the creativity comes up. Now, Thorsten, when we first met, and Emma, I would like to, and our dear viewers, I would like to share that story. It was a couple of years ago. I had the pleasure to go to travel to Singapore to do a program with senior leaders at Roche, and I had the pleasure to travel to Rotkreuz and meet my collaborator and co-trainer. And so I did that. I traveled to Rotkreuz, which is a place in Switzerland. And I met Thorsten. That was my first encounter with Thorsten. So this was a program which was combining the organizational aspect of agile transformation, the mind, the work on the mindset, and then also the aspect of mindfulness. And Thorsten, I will never forget when we sat. So honestly, you shared with me that, you know, Christoph, I look forward to travel with you to Singapore and work with you over these couple of days. But to be very honest, mindfulness doesn't work for me, and I don't really believe in it also. And I sat there, and I was kind of two things happened simultaneously. I felt so, I don't know, connected to you because you were honest, you were vulnerable, you were just speaking out what you were thinking. And at the same time, I was wondering how on earth is this going to work out? I know that today you're a mindfulness trainer yourself. And so it would be so interesting for me to hear your journey, kind of what made you kind of change your mind, and how do you see that role of mindfulness today from where you stand?
Yeah, so I remember that meeting very well, because I remember you turning all pale when I said I don't really believe in this, but I'm looking forward to our collaboration. And at the time, my belief was driven by what I perceived mindfulness to be in that moment. And it was something that went in my mind hand in hand with, we gotta light a couple of candles now and all get a cup of tea and get in our yoga pants and you know, save the world. And once we're done, we'll go outside, hug some trees, and everything will be good. That was mindfulness in my mind. And I did not see how on earth that should help the leaders I work with to serve the purpose of the organization better than all the other things we do with them. But I felt, I think we had a similar experience. I felt something very sincere and authentic in how you talked about mindfulness. And I was curious to find out how it will work out. And we were brought together by a former colleague of mine, somebody I hold in high regard, and I trust her judgment. And so I figured, well, if it's okay for her, we'll give it a try, see where it goes. And then in that first session we did in Singapore with a very, very business focused team, with a very tough leader, you know, not the easiest client you can have for this kind of topic. It worked exceptionally well. And I had the feeling we're taking them to a place that they've never been before, and they'd never find this place on their own. And it's working. I can't really explain it, but something is happening here. I'm observing something. And of course, we had a couple of conversations when we went for dinners together and so on. I observed this, and plus I myself am that kind of individual that, and I think you described earlier, I've always been very driven. I can't stop my brain from working. I'm constantly thinking. I'm constantly processing. Logic is my currency. And so the only times when my brain, when I felt my brain stops working is when I go for a run and get into that flow state, or I go ski mountaineering and I walk up the mountain and I have the feeling my brain just stops working. So that flow state that you've both described earlier, that worked. But I can't always go for a run or put on the skis and walk up a mountain just to relax my brain for a moment. And in the conversations that we had, Christoph, I sensed that, well, maybe this breathing thing could work for me. And turned out it did. And so observing something with some of our toughest business leaders and experiencing it myself and putting together the pieces just led to me then wanting to dive deeper and getting the accreditation for the topic. And here we are.
And what a beautiful journey. Now, today you are delivering mindfulness programs within Roche. How is that for you now, being at the other end of the table? Are you getting paid yourself, or is it a very smooth endeavor?
No, I think it's a fantastic addition to all the other things we do with leaders and team members in Roche to help them develop, because we are in this situation. You've talked about the VUCA world before, and now we've got this pandemic on top of it, and so we've got a lot of things that can scare you and probably should scare you, and fear is not a good consultant, you know. So we're all. The level of anxiety or fear that we have has been elevated in the past 12, 15 months for all of us, whether we want to admit it or not. We're more afraid now than we were 15 months ago. Yet this situation that creates this fear and anxiety also requires us to find those creative solutions to get out of this place again and be able to move on. So we somehow got to break that pattern, right? And I think breathing techniques can be a fantastic way to do that. You know, there might be other ways that work equally well. But breathing is something very simple that can be trained relatively easily, relatively quickly, and can have an impact very quickly. And since we don't have endless amounts of time to train people on other techniques and processes and so on, I think it's a fantastic fit for the situation we are facing.
And you're talking about the patterns, and probably the freedom many a times is between that stimuli and our response. Sometimes we simply react. I mean, we talk agile, we want to be creative, we want to be innovative, but then maybe we go to a meeting. There are a couple of people around the table or in the Zoom meeting, and maybe we react in a way which we don't like, and we are kind of not satisfied at the end of the meeting. We go back and we say to ourselves, you know, next time I'm going to do it all different. You know, I'm going to be a different me, and I'm going to be very calm and wise. And there the meeting comes, and guess what? The chances are that I will show the same behavior again. So these reactive loops, I think we all know them, and it's not easy to overcome them. And so breathing techniques, and that's my experience as well, can help us to kind of practice presence, right? And probably the more we do it, the more easier it is to then also experience these moments of presence when things are really very hectic. I think it has never been a wise idea to learn martial arts on the battlefield, right? So we couldn't really experiment with these breathing techniques right there in an important meeting. But withdrawing, taking time, practicing that presence muscle, how I would call it, probably comes handy and helps us to develop a culture of presence in crucial meetings, and then that little moment between maybe a stimuli, between that comment that somebody makes and then my conscious response can make the world of a difference. And so to Emma, my question is, according to your experience, how long does it take for this, let's say, training effect to start happening, right? I think people can have a good experience, they relax and let go, but how long does it take so that you actually can take that presence in crucial, difficult situations and meetings where maybe fear and stress pops up?
Yeah. So you're so right. I mean, if we know that when you're stressed, you literally see less things. Like, you physically see less things. You're restricted. Now, there's probably an evolutionary reason for that. Like, we were meant to save our life. I mean, we're only supposed to feel stress 5 minutes in our life right before we die. That's a quote from Robert Sapolsky, a stress professor, scientist at Stanford. And really, the idea is we're only supposed to feel stress when we are in a life or death situation and we're being chased by a predator, right? Not all the time, but stress really does narrow our vision and narrows our ability to see from a broader perspective. And I would argue that we are very well trained to be stressed. Even if we complain about stress, many of us worship at the temple of stress. What I mean by that is there's sort of this idea that in order to be productive, in order to get things done, you need to have this high adrenaline, more coffee, and be stressed. The sense that I can't get any work done unless that's happening. That's why that coffee machine's in every workplace. But the problem is that we're not supposed to feel stressed chronically. And when we do, we actually wear down all of the systems that are amplified, but are only supposed to be amplified in this sort of acute sense during danger. But when they're amplified chronically, like your immune system, your cognition, your attention, your memory, all of the things that are very sharp, during stress, when it's chronic, all of those things start to get depleted. And that's why you see over long-term burnout, fatigue, anxiety, all of those things. So, but we're very well trained. Even before pre-pandemic, we're very well trained to be stressed and to activate it voluntarily with the sense that we'll be more productive, which is actually false. But so now I would say that, you know, really it depends where your nervous system is at, but we can train ourselves for stress resilience. We can train ourselves as long as we learn to activate and sort of train like a muscle, the other side of our nervous system, the parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest, the opposite of the fight or flight, the calming, restorative part of our nervous system where we're actually meant to be for 95% of our life. You know, if you look at even animals in the savannah who are being chased by a predator, within minutes of being out of danger, they're just totally relaxed again. Why? Because in that space, you restore your body, you restore your cognitive faculties. There's a very loud helicopter flying overhead in case you hear that. But so you're asking, you know, how long does it take to build? Well, really, first of all, it depends where you're at when you start. But I would say that it's so important to think of building stress resilience as a muscle, and using breathing techniques, I think, is one of the most efficient, fastest way to train yourself, because you're tapping right into the parasympathetic nervous system. So we've worked with veterans with trauma who it's like they're in this heightened state of fight or flight all the time. And they have a real show me attitude. Like, they don't want any BS. You know, it's like, okay, is this going to work? I want to find out in minutes. And within minutes, they notice a shift, because within minutes of doing long, slow, deep breathing and long exhales, boom, they feel calmer. And so that's something that you can notice right away. I mean, it happens right away. So I would say, you know, probably at least a daily practice for a couple of weeks, you should start to see a difference. And I think we see that also through in the research. And this is a long answer, but I'll just end with this one study that was conducted at Harvard by colleagues of mine that they replicated the study we ran at Yale with students. But what they did was they also measured physiological changes. And what they saw was that before and after having learned the breathing technique, as opposed to the other group that had learned more cognitive reframing techniques, they showed less of a stress response physiologically in terms of heart rate and heart rate variability when about to enter a very stressful situation. So literally in that moment where they're anticipating entering a stressful situation, speaking in public, they have less of a stress response compared to before and compared to the control group. So you can see that physiology. We also saw that with veterans, a physiological change. So that's when you know that there's something happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when we are stressed, and I think it's a actually a very strong image that we should only be stressed really at the time of death. But when we are stressed, I think we are much more likely to show our reactive behaviors, right? And then we are far away from that creative space. So I'm wondering, Thorsten, now, your experience, an organization of 95,000 people, and this organization is in an ecosystem of the corona pandemic, is going through tremendous transformational processes in the organization itself, I understand. So how do you see the stress levels at the organization and how are people coping with what is happening right now?
Well, I guess the quick and honest answer is from two. You know, you'll find people who cope with it in a very good way because they've got their routines. They've learned about their reactions. They've done something about it and they manage to deal with it in a pretty good way. And then you've got people who are driven by the transformation monster that chases them down the corridor and then the pandemic on top of that and so on. And for them, it's a miserable time. I assume it's very difficult and there's no light at the end of the tunnel. And I think what makes it especially difficult for them is that, well, if we enter this world of agility, we're not replacing the old dogma with a new dogma, right? We're trying to get rid of the dogma and try to be flexible and deal with what's waiting for us out there and find the best fitting way of dealing with any given situation. So a lot of that perceived stability that they had in the old dogma is going away and is not being replaced with anything as tangible yet. So that is scary for a lot of people. I'd say it's scary for most of us. And so we really have the entire bandwidth of reactions currently. But given this very unique situation that we are in, and also colleagues in other pharmaceutical companies like the ones that are developing the vaccines or something, it's enormously stressful. And on top of all of that, I think we also need to acknowledge that it's not only agility that helps us to launch these products quicker and find these vaccines. It's also that people work 24/7. Currently, well, those teams work a lot. You know, I would say for the teams who are at the forefront, it's been a reality for a while and probably still is for those who work in the vaccine world. They haven't seen their family in quite a while, right? Because they are so absorbed by living up to the purpose and delivering something and doing something and helping and taking it to the next level that they forget about this other side. And that's a big risk that I think the senior leaders need to have an eye on currently, because that is something that is happening. So yeah, it's everything. It's really people who take this self-care aspect serious, do something about it, and hence find their ways of dealing with this very stressful time. And they are those who are driven by the workload and the next project and so on. We have everything, but I think we have more in the first group every week. You know, because there's a lot happening within the organization. The topic of mindfulness has picked up dramatically over the past 12 months, I would say. When the first lockdown started, we offered Well, at least for the Swiss population, and I think also for the German population. And at one point, we offered 2 mindfulness sessions a day. We help try to give people a hand disconnecting before they go to the lunch table and meet their families. And then also disconnecting again in the evening when the work is done before they walk back into their families, right? Because it's all happening in the same 25 square meters now. There's no drive to the office and from the office anymore where you can drive the system down and disconnect and get ready for meeting the kids and so on and the husband and wife. So we try to embed it into their reality, and that worked pretty well in the beginning, I would say. And that's why it picked up really enormously over the past 12 months. And now it's actually a pull and not a push anymore. It was a push in the beginning. It's now definitely a pull.
That's really fantastic. And so we have many thousand people viewing this podcast live, and many more will see it in the future. And I thought that we talked about the world, the VUCA world. We talked about the corona influencing us. We talked about organizations. But let's also talk about ourselves. And maybe both of you could share a tip with the audience. I was wondering, would you mind sharing with the audience, what are you actually doing? How are you coping with the stress? Imagine, you know that tomorrow you will have a very important presentation. Something is in your way. You realize that some stress is coming up. What do you do to manage yourself? Maybe the audience could learn from you. And I want to start with Emma. You look so relaxed anyhow, or whenever I see you.
Well, I mean, I definitely, you know, do the sky breath meditation daily. There's just too much evidence now to let that go by. And I also meditate twice a day. But the one thing that I also do that I find tremendously beneficial is to try and go out into nature at least 15 minutes a day if I can. You know, I know that's not always available to everyone living in a city, but I noticed it makes a huge difference. And I also know the research shows it makes a tremendous difference for your emotional well-being, but also for your mental well-being, for your mental faculties, and even for your relationships. And this is science that people don't always know about because no one's out there marketing it because no one's going to make any money off of it. But I find that there's a lot of research on it, but also just my own research, you know, where our body is our lab. And I find that really beneficial.
That's beautiful. The body is our lab. So, Thorsten, where do you find refuge, so to say?
Many things, different things, actually. It's definitely also the breathing elements that I build in, and I'm probably not on the same level that the two of you seem to be on. You seem to be much more, I don't know whether rigid is the right word about it, but I don't manage to do it every day. I'm not yet at that stage where I can say it's a first thing in the morning. But what I always manage to do and what I always try to do is when the stress builds up, think about what does me good, you know, and sometimes that's putting the headphones on and listening to Miles Davis, or sometimes it's cuddling the dogs that sleep here to my left and to my right now. And sometimes it's a good meal or a glass of wine or something, but something that I know will do me good now. And that changes. You know, sometimes it's not music, and music would drive me crazy, but it's that glass of wine now or a good meal or playing with the dogs or something. But I know it will do me good now, and it will take me to a different place for those few minutes.
Beautiful. And I think, you know, many a times mindfulness is just looked at as a technique, and obviously it is a technique, but maybe more importantly, it's a state of mind. It's these moments when we are really present. And I remember Emma and Thorsten a couple of weeks ago, a participant in one of our Active Train the Trainer programs was telling me, you know, I'm confused because, okay, breathing techniques, that's quite useful, but I feel most happy when I do my shopping, you know. So you're saying shopping is my mindfulness, and well, good point. You know, if shopping brings us to the present moment, then so be it. Then that is what we should do. I think many a times, though, probably we would say not every time we go shopping we have this beautiful state of presence, but whatever does the trick is good. And for me at the moment, really, it's very much like Emma is saying, the nature. Actually, I have, as I'm not able to go to the fitness studio, I go to the forest almost every day, and listening to the birds brings me to the present moment and makes me feel just good and rich from within, and actually grateful. And I think gratefulness is something extremely powerful. And it connects us to maybe something bigger in our life. So thank you so much to both of you for this conversation. And as these are difficult times, I actually wanted to ask you one last question. And that is, and you're not really connected to mindfulness, but I just wanted to ask you both from your very rich experience, what is it that at the moment gives you hope, let's say, for us as a humanity, that we will move to this crisis, let's say, in a way that that allows us to be healthy, happy, and in a good place? And maybe, I don't know who would like to go first.
Shall I start this time, Emma? So you had to take the last one, so I'll take this one. So what gives me hope in this crazy situation is that I think it helped a lot of us to recalibrate, reevaluate what's really important for us. You know, I feel the world is a crazy place right now, but I also feel that it was a crazy place when this hit us. And some things had been getting out of control. And I think this pandemic, as terrible as it is in its effect, it helped us to recalibrate and value things again that we had forgotten to value, beforehand. And that, I think, is something very positive, because that shows me that we are capable of that. We can rebound as a human race, and we can focus again on what's really important, regardless of how crazy it is around us. That's, I think, what gives me hope.
Very powerful. Thank you. Thank you, Thorsten.
Yeah, I love what you said, Thorsten. You know, I think it's made people become more contemplative, which is just so powerful. So, to what Thorsten said, and the other thing that gives me hope is that I feel like, you know, so many people have helped each other out during this time. And whenever I hear about those stories of neighbors helping neighbors, raising money for this person, that person, you know, that gives me hope. You know, it's always like human beings are good. Human beings want to help each other. You know, there's this whole message out there that human beings are selfish and ego-driven first and foremost. But if you look at the data, that's actually not the case. If you look at the data, when people are given the zero-sum game or some kind of prisoner's dilemma, and they're given just a few seconds to answer, they're going to choose the fair choice. They're going to share, right? If you give them longer, then maybe they'll start thinking, okay, I don't know. But the first impulse is always to help. And you see that even in infants and in children or in toddlers, their first impulse is to share, to give. And that's been shown in a number of studies. And so it just always that reminder of just the goodness of human nature, of how much people have come together to try and help and support each other. That is inspiring to me. And that just shows, you know, that the resilience of the human spirit and the goodness of the human spirit in general. So.
Wow, that's very beautiful. So the first real instinct of us is to actually help, and that's beautiful. You know, it reminds me of a study, which was actually done in the 1970s in the UK, when we still had the phone booths. So what they did, and Emma, you will be familiar with that study, is that they had people come to the phone booth, and they staged an old lady in front of this phone booth. And she had her shopping bags, and then you could see that she needed help. So what they did, one group actually, in this phone booth, when they were trying to do a call, they found the coin, right, a pound coin. And the other group did not find the pound coin. So obviously the group which found the pound coin was elevated. And in this experiment, it was shown that more than 80% of the people who found the coin afterwards were ready to help this lady. But the group of people who did not find the coin, it was less than 10% actually. And I think that goes to show that that state of our own mind is so important, because when we are elevated, and I don't want to say that we need to find coins, but if we are elevated, if we are connected to ourselves, then we are also more connected to others. And I think what gives me hope is that, in one way or another, this crisis has forced us to stop. And I think the agility is also about both running and stopping, and then maybe re-engaging in the activity with more wisdom. And it definitely stopped me, and it stopped all of us. And I think in that moment of being stopped, I think some of the conversations I was able to have with people, and some of the conversations which take place in the world, I feel are more from the heart and are more purpose-driven. And I think we are asking ourselves a couple of really important questions, and that definitely gives me hope. These moments when we greet each other, really, maybe the neighbors out there, really from the heart instead of just from the lips, these are the moments which fill my heart and give me hope. And I also very much appreciate the way we were able to interact, Emma and Thorsten, tonight. And for you, it's the afternoon, Emma. Thank you so much. I think this was also conversations both from the head and the heart. You shared so much about your very vast professional experience, and you shared a couple of very personal insights into your lives. And for that, I'm deeply grateful. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. This was great. And thanks to the audience for joining the Telex podcast, which is streamed tonight in collaboration with the World Forum for Ethics in Business. Thanks a lot.
Thanks to you both. It was wonderful just to connect.
Absolutely. Thanks, Christoph, for organizing this.